I'm getting old, sensitive to cold. Wait, are you guys there? I guess you left.
Welcome to the Negative World Podcast, the podcast about video games by the Nintendo fans at NegativeWorld.org. This is episode 39, and we are recording this on Wednesday, October 17th, 2012. I'm your host, Steven, or as I'm known on the boards, Dr. Finkelstein. And with me is my pal and co-host, Ninsage.
Hey, this is Joe, and today I'm going to be talking about things I'd like to see happen in future Pokemon games.
And also with us is our special guest, and he is indeed special. He is the Negative World Podcast co-founder and now editor and key voice on the Nintendo World Report podcast, Guillaume.
Hi. I am going to be talking about local multiplayer of any kind.
Yeah, welcome back, Guillaume.
Hey, thanks.
And my topic a little later in the show is going to be about the classic and beloved Time Splitter series. First-person shooters on the game. It was a first-person shooter on the GameCube, and we just want to talk about that. So let's jump right in to now playing. Guillaume?
Awesome. Well, I have been playing a lot, but let's just focus on two games. I have been talking about this on the radio for Nintendo, but I can talk about it some more. I've been playing Persona 3 on the PlayStation Portable. And I'm a fan of the franchise, I suppose. I played Persona 4 first because it was highly recommended to me. The Persona series is part of a larger series called Shin Megami Tensei, which is its own kind of mega franchise with its own mythology, I suppose. And the one link that I can see that all the different, you know, smaller franchises have together, the one common point is that it's always about people summoning demons to fight other demons. And most of the time, the setting is, you know, Japan and probably modern-day Japan or modern-day Alaska in the case of Devil Survivor, I think. It's very, very strange. It's very, very... It's a role-playing game series. But when we think role-playing games, usually we think like wizards and adventurers. Like you've got the fighter and the red mage, black mage, and whatever. And so I really appreciate what I played of Persona because it's an entirely different setting. Usually you play as high school kids who... you know, can summon these personas and they're the only ones aware that there are demons, just roaming around, preying on people. And so, yeah, it's a cool change of pace.
So is there multiple Persona games?
Yeah. Yeah. As I said, I played Persona 4 first, but there was 1, 2, and 3.
Yeah.
1 and 2 were PlayStation 1 games and they were pretty different from 3 and 4. I haven't played them. They look really, really, basic and, yeah, very different and not too appealing visually, to be honest. But 3 and 4, they share the same director. I think they're made by the same team. And so, they kind of animated up, you know, like you've got really, the character portraits look like, well, not unlike the characters from, Trauma Center, you know, like the other Atlus anime franchise. Mm-hmm. And yeah, like they kind of share the same structure, which is that you go to school every day. You kind of, you know, like the days go from, you know, afternoon to after school to evening. And so Monday through Saturday, every day you go to school and then you go to some, you know, after school activity or you go work part time or, you can just go and choose to explore this dungeon. It sounds strange when said like this, but I mean, it's just like a choice. It's just, okay, what do you decide to do with this time slot, and everything is everything else is automatic. You know, like if you choose to study, then you get points for studying, like academics points, and eventually that stat is going to level up. But you, it's not as if you have to do anything. It's just like, okay, I choose to spend my character's time like this. And so you level up in order to, yeah, you can study in order to level up certain characteristics. You can also decide to spend time with people. And the different relationships that you have with the different characters decide how powerful your demons are going to be. Each demon is of one of 12 different arcanas that they're called. And you can have basically 12 different relationships with different people. And each of these people represent a different arcana. And so the more you spend time with them, the more you learn about them. Like there's this kind of little story that you can follow about them. So the more time that you spend with them, the more powerful the demons of that arcana, you know, become powerful. And yeah,
what,
like,
I'm sorry, what, like, I know you said this is like a spin-off from Shin Megami Tensei.
Yeah.
So, first of all, is it like the, like, are the fictional worlds directly connected, or is it a totally separate universe?
I really have no idea.
Okay.
I haven't played the other Shin Megami Tensei series. It seems complicated. I mean, there's Shin Megami Tensei, the main series, and the fourth game in that, the main series, is going to be on 3DS.
Okay.
But you've got different spin-offs. You've got Devil Survivor, which was on DS, and that had a sequel. You have Persona, which has been mostly in PlayStation 1 and 2. They do share a mythology. I don't know if it's a Final Fantasy type of thing where it's always completely separate stories and most of the time in different worlds, but mm-hmm. with like the same common elements of, well, you know, you can summon Ifrit or Bahamut,
right,
you know.
Right. Do you know if there's a substantial gameplay difference between the various titles?
Well, yeah, there would be. I mean, in Persona, you can summon these demons, and it kind of works like a Pokemon game in a way. You know, you can have with you a couple of demons, and you know, like in your roster, and you can switch between them in battle. But you know, like you can only have say 12 at a time, and if you catch a 13th one after a battle, then you know you have to release another one, or you can fuse them into more powerful demons. So yeah, there's this kind of Pokemon element to it. So that's Persona. But other games have different mechanics to them. I think that in Devil Survivor, basically you have to defeat demons and they'll join you. But after you've answered some sort of morality question, and you know, like it's not always clear exactly what you're supposed to answer. It depends on what the demon believes, and I don't know how we're supposed to know what a demon believes, but, you know, like, that's why I kind of stayed away from the other series in the Shin Megami universe. You know, like, it seems a little bit more complicated.
Which is the one where people shoot themselves in the head?
Yeah, that's the one I'm playing right now.
Okay.
They're not really shooting themselves in the head, although, yeah, that's the iconic... they're not revolvers, they're evokers for some reason. And, yeah, they don't literally shoot themselves bullets in their heads.
Okay.
You know, there's kind of confetti coming out of, you know, the other side of their head. It's pretty weird. It's, you know, it's very, very Japanese.
It certainly sounds interesting.
It is. It is.
I've looked at them in the past. Like they've caught my eye. But I don't know why. For some reason, I like. It's intimidating. I don't know. Maybe
I agree. The series has a very, very, you know, hardcore following. So like the PlayStation 2 fans talking to each other about this series. Like you when you're looking from outside, looking in, you know, it just sounds like, what the hell are they talking about? And like, that sounds so weird. But once you start playing it, it's very, very easy. The game really eases you in. And it doesn't introduce every element all at once. So it's, you know, it gives you time to get acclimated to, the different mechanics and the you know, like, get used to the world. And no, it's very friendly. But for some reason, yeah, I'm still intimidated by the rest of the like the other sub-series. So, but I want to dig in at some point, like with the Shin Megami Tensei 4 coming to 3DS. You know, like, it seems like a good moment to really get in and explore the rest of the different sub-series.
Sure.
Yeah. So I've been playing that. If you want to hear more about that, I guess you can listen to Radio for Nintendo. But yeah, like, don't be too intimidated by the series. It's really, there's nothing to be really afraid of. I would say start with 4. It's definitely the superior game. It's got a more intriguing scenario right at the beginning. A story about, you know, you come to this small town and you're living with your uncle who's a cop, and there is this series of murders, and people, like, corpses just show up hanging upside down from TV antennas. And so, you know, like, there's this really, really morbid kind of side to the story. And then, anyway, I don't want to reveal too much of the plot, but it's pretty intriguing. And it's not something that you're used to in RPGs usually. Yeah, the second game that I wanted to talk about is a little DSiWare game that I probably wouldn't have played if I had not, you know, received a code to download it. It's only $2, though, so I feel pretty confident in, I feel pretty confident in recommending it to people. It's Robot Rescue 2, a DSiWare game. It's a puzzle game, and given the Mole Mania that hit the Negative World board a couple of weeks ago, I think that a lot of people would really like it. You've probably played games like it before. You've got these different robots on this, well, first, like, the level will fill up both screens of your DS, which you hold as you would hold a book. And so that's the entire playing field. And you've got these different robots, and they move, by tiles, you know, like one tile to the left, to the right. And each tile might have hazards, you know, like, mines or, electric wires. So you have to avoid the hazards. And you have to guide every robot to one of several exits. And so you control them all at the same time. If you press left, they all step to the left. So you've got to use the different walls, you know, to... Okay, so like this one, if I step to the left, he's going to overshoot the exit. So I got to make sure that, you know, he just bumps into a wall at some point and... do you understand what I'm talking about?
Yeah, then there's like a lot of other games seem to have puzzles like this. It'll be a small element in their game, right? I mean, it's a sort of I think it is a puzzle type we've all probably experienced at some point. It is, I guess, a little bit hard to describe verbally, but
it is. But just look at some, you know, there are trailers out there on YouTube, so just Google Robot Rescue 2 and you'll see what I'm talking about. But yeah, like the main strength of this game, I think, are that it's only $2, so very, very, very affordable. It has 60 levels, and beyond the initial, say, 9 tutorial levels, they're really, really, really hard.
Okay.
So I don't know if, you know, like I like Nintendo puzzle games, I like Pushmo, I like Mole Mania, I like all that kind of stuff, but or Picross. But a lot of times when you start these games, the tutorial just won't end and they force you to play all the easy puzzles before unlocking the more advanced ones. And, sometimes, you know, I get a little bit irritated by that because, you know, like once you get it, you kind of want to move on to the meat of the game. And most of the time, Nintendo games won't let you, not right away. And so, you know, something like Pushmo feels like it's got 90 tutorial levels. But this game only has 9. And then it's just, even the first, tutorial level in which it said, okay, so I'm gonna give you this tutorial level with all the elements that we've seen. So try to complete it. And I died a couple of times trying to solve that one. So the very, very last tutorial level, which was basically, okay, apply what you learned, was already difficult. So,
So, you know, how do you how do you die, per se? Like, I know you said there's hazards, but does that mean you can, like, lose a robot permanently for that level, or?
Yeah, the, basically, the game is very unforgiving, and if a single robot dies by stepping on a tile that he's not supposed to step on, then, the game immediately, you know, resets the level.
Gotcha.
So, yeah, you just have to keep trying until you get it right.
There's no time limit on these levels, is there?
No, except for maybe 20 levels of the 60 levels, which are more kind of action-based. You know, like they'll start your robots in conveyor belts, and you have to be really, really quick about, you know, like hitting certain switches to make sure that the conveyor belts lead them to the exit and not to, you know, some mine.
Right, and so thus, if you got off the conveyor belt, then you have infinite time to think about your next move, but they force you into, you know, quick thinking.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, while looking on this online, it seems like it's kind of like, you know, in Twilight Princess, there's that one puzzle. It's the one right before, just a major plot point. I guess it won't be too specific, but it's the two statues puzzle in Twilight Princess, pretty much,
yeah.
But on a grander scale with more complex puzzles and everything. Kind of. I mean, I think in Twilight Princess, I forget exactly how it worked, but it seems kind of like that, where your movements affect everything else in the same manner, and then you kind of got to wiggle your way through.
Yeah, I think that in Twilight Princess, the statues had mirrored movement, though.
Right, yeah. That's why I'm not convinced it's exactly the same, but...
Yeah, but it's basically the same principle. You know, you move them all at the same time, and you got to figure out, you know, how to get them all safely to the exit without killing one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And, there's not really that much more to say about it. It's just, it will probably keep you busy for a couple of hours. And, for $2, I think, you could do worse.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's, you know, not too ugly to look at. I mean, the art is pretty nice, I think. And, for a $2 game. And, go for it. I mean, if you like Mole Mania, if you like just like staring at one screen and just scratching your head and going like, how the hell do I solve this? Then, you can get more of that for $2. Go for it.
Okay. Well, Joe, you've been playing some games, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So let us know what's up.
Well, I've still been working on Pokemon Platinum. I'm not going to say too much about it, especially since, I'm sure I'll be talking a lot about it when I get into my main topic, but, just as an update, I have, as of yesterday, gotten the 7th gym badge, and I'm sort of, you know, I'm going to start leveling up everybody and sort of gearing up for that that final push and the Elite Four and all that. I have been having a good time with, my wife has been playing through the game as well. She's got her copy, and she actually started probably maybe about 2 years ago or something like that. And she actually just beat the Elite Four over the weekend. So, you know, she plays at a different pace than I do. We're actually, since we're at such sort of even points, you know, it's pretty good because we're able to battle and trade. And it's nice to have some sort of, I don't know if local co-op is the right word, if it's handhelds. But have someone else to actually play through a game with, and,
sure.
And you know, so
did the diamond come with the Poke Walker?
No, that was the Heart Gold Soul Silver, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. Mm, but isn't Diamond kind of the third one in that?
No, Platinum is the third one.
Yeah, it's Diamond, okay. Diamond, Pearl, and then Platinum.
Yep,
I see.
Yep.
Just a side note, I did like the idea of the Poke Walker.
Kind of a shame it doesn't continue.
Yeah, I kind of used it at the beginning. I do have a copy of Pokemon Gold, which I stopped playing once I had to teach one of my Pokemons Surf. So I'm not very far into it. For a couple of weeks, I was really into the Poke Walker.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, everyone was saying that when they heard about how you would collect coins on the 3DS just by, you know, carrying it around and how it basically was like a Poke Walker. I mean, I think... everyone is sort of assuming that there'll be that element in whatever the 3DS game is, don't you think?
One can hope, yeah.
I mean, do you think it can, you know, affect game data when it's in sleep mode like that, or?
Oh, yeah, I'm pretty sure it can.
They could probably figure that out.
Or at least it could calculate stuff and then instantly apply it when you wake it up from sleep. Because, like, even playing the DS game, I mean, Black 2, which is what I'm playing, it's a DS game, just like Black and any of the other games. But if you just put it in sleep mode in the morning and then you wake, or you come home from work or something and play it at night, it'll just instantly change to night, you know, right in front of your eyes. So it just has to adjust for a split second. So I'm sure they could do that with your coins that you accumulate or...
Gotcha.
Without it being too obtrusive, you know.
Yeah. But aside from that, I got together with a bunch of friends over the weekend. A bunch of people I know, they do this thing two or three times a year where they just all kind of like between 8 and 12 of us just sort of get together and, you know, play games for 14 hours straight or something like that. So it's a lot of fun. But a bunch of people had their 3DSs and their DSIs, and so I actually got to play Zelda Four Swords, the version that was available for free download. I think it was last year, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I had never played it before. I think I'd loaded it up, you know, just to see what it was, but I was not, the single player idea was not really alluring enough for me to really try it out. So, So there was three of us, and I gotta say, you know, it was pretty darn fun. I think we all had a good time with it, but unfortunately, because there was like so much, other gaming going on, you know, people were taking turns going through Majora's Mask on the TV and everything. So we only did one, area, I guess you'd call it. It mm-hmm. was the one, the forest one. I don't know. Guillaume, do you happen to remember the name of? I don't remember.
Yeah, I couldn't tell you.
But anyway, but it was really cool. I mean, I don't know really how to describe it other than it's, you know, it's kind of its own beast, but it's, you know, it's basically like you just go through and solve puzzles. And I remember from, I think it was Anand's description of the game, from the Negative World meetup. Was this not the game where he was talking about the griefing people?
Yeah, the one that we played was Four Swords Adventure on the GameCube. So that's the one where you have all your GBAs connected to a GameCube. Gotcha. And I haven't played the Four Swords GBA recently enough to really tell you what the difference is. But I seem to remember that the DSI version that we got might be a little bit more puzzle oriented, and the GameCube version seemed to be more hectic, more action oriented, and there were, I think, more opportunities for griefing.
Right. I mean, this had, you know, there were enemies, there was at least one boss battle, and sort of like, I think, enemies that would qualify as mini bosses, but truly they were few and far between, and it really was just about how you sort of work together to solve these puzzles. And it was, you know, I mean, that was really fun. There were a number of spots where I think you have to enjoy this to enjoy the game, but there were a number of spots where we were like, I mean, we didn't know what the controls really were. So like there was a spot where there was a moat and a switch on the other side. And clearly, we knew if we can push that switch, it'll extend this bridge and then we can get across to the other side. But for about 10 minutes, we didn't know that you could pick each other up and throw each other. So we were like tossing bombs across and trying to get them on the switch. And we were just looking for other, you know, like secret ways over the water or anything. And then, yeah, eventually 10 minutes in, I was just like, I have a theory. And I walked up to this girl and just picked her up, and then it was pretty good from there. But also, you know, like stuff like there'd be a big heavy block, and you know, two of us would try to push it, and we'd kind of give up and say, okay, well that's not it, but you need all three of you to be pushing it. So so you know, it's working together, it's co-op in the truest sense of the word, it's mild puzzle solving. There is that competitive aspect where you are collecting rupees, and technically at the end of an area they kind of give like a little honor to whoever gets the most. But I don't know, is that the same reward in the version you guys played, Guillaume?
Yeah, kind of.
Is it just like you're the winner, like in Mario Party, and you move on?
Yeah, but there's also, I don't know, it seemed more, maybe it was because of the people I was with, but, you know, like I was playing with Anand, but yeah, like you pick up these kind of Triforce pieces or whatever they are, and not only do you have to be the one who collects the most, but at the end of a level, other people can vote on who's been, you know, like the biggest jerk and who's been the most helpful. And so the biggest jerk, you know, is deducted 50 pieces, Triforce pieces, and, you know, the person the most helpful gets 50. And yeah, so there's, you know, like a lot of possibilities for you know, like just taking revenge on people or, yeah, I don't know. Like the game did seem to encourage that more, but not really in any, you know, like long-lasting way. Like it's not as if you got the most pieces, you could unlock something. Sure. It was just more for bragging rights.
Gotcha.
Have either of you played the single player of any version of this that has it?
No, not really, no.
Because that's the only way I've been able to enjoy these games, and I'm just continually kind of disappointed that I haven't been able to have the experiences you guys have had. Because it is fun by itself. I mean, it's like playing Zelda, you know?
Yeah, but in the DSi game, it's you end up controlling both, like, right, two Links at the same time, right?
Yeah, and you can separate yourself from them, but then, you know, he just sits there like a doofus, you know? It doesn't feel very action-packed or energetic.
It feels like playing Monopoly against yourself.
Pretty much, yes. And
Monopoly, sorry. Playing Monopoly, Jesus.
We know what you meant.
Yeah. But yeah, so it's kind of a letdown if you're playing it like that. But yeah, maybe someday I'll be able to experience it like you guys have.
Yeah, I hope so.
Well, hopefully there's going to be an online version at some point down the line. You know, I mean, the Wii U would be a perfect way to do that. Really, they could use the touch screen of the gamepad to still give you that kind of touch control if you'd like, and then their whole online network. I mean, they have that same kind of network with the 3DS, but maybe it's more marketable as a console game or something.
Yeah, Nintendo sometimes is weird, you know, like, we often have, you know, ideas about what's obvious for them to make, you know, like, I don't think I was the only one who was wondering, well, when are they going to make Mario Paint for the Wii? Because it seemed to be kind of a, you know, like, a, so obvious, and then they don't do it. So who knows, like, maybe they will skip a gen with, Four Swords, and, we'll see.
Yeah.
So the last thing I've been playing is, Sin and Punishment Star Successor, which is a game that I had, I'd wanted to get it since it was announced. For some reason, I just never did. Finally, it was $5 at Best Buy a couple months ago, so.
You lucky bastard.
Yeah, so I was like, well, this'll do. So I'm not very far into it. I think I've beaten the first three or four levels, depending on if you count that first sort of tutorial level. Mm-hmm. And man, first of all, have you guys played it?
Yeah.
I haven't, no.
Okay.
I gotta say, like, you're interested in story in games. I will be honest, I skipped the cutscenes because there was no way I was sitting through that. What's your opinion?
Well, that's exactly, thanks for touching on that for me, because, yeah, I mean, man, I don't know. It's like, when I look at the box, okay, the box art, right, trying to judge a book by its cover, it looks like there's some interesting stuff going on here. And I remembered hearing stories about even the N64 game, like around the time when it was first, put up on the North American, Virtual Console. Mm-hmm. About, like, oh, you know, it's all this crazy gene splicing, and you're gonna be fighting, like, these robot chicken things, and just, you know, just all this insanity. And I thought, like, man, like, you know, I can't wait to see, I don't know if explanation is the right word, but I guess I can't wait to see how it, you know, fits together, like, how this is all woven together. And I really don't think I'm missing anything having not played the first, Sin and Punishment.
Nope.
But this one, it's really just like, here it is. And again, I'm only into the first couple levels. I'm sure there's going to be some sort of quote unquote twist with the female character at some point because she's like not human. And that's made clear after, I think, the first or second level. Mm-hmm. But other than that, yeah, it just seems so, like, in terms of the story, in terms of the plot, it's just so, like, superficial. You know, like, it really just seems to be an excuse to make these crazy levels to fly through and have interesting stuff to shoot at, which is not necessarily a bad thing or some sort of damnation of the game. But, you know, again, for me personally, I haven't yet gotten what I was hoping to out of this game. I've right. always loved shmups, and but that said, I haven't played too many of this style where you can move yourself and the cursor independently.
Right.
And so, you know, it is fun like that. I get the sense that this is really set up to be a score attack type game. So in which case, you know, actually like beating the single player on your own might not feel like much of an accomplishment. Like, it doesn't feel very difficult so far. Mm-hmm. But I get the sense it would be extremely difficult to, you know, try to get that, extra 1,000 points or whatever to, you know, beat your friend on the leaderboard. I feel like that's really where the motivation to master the game is supposed to come from.
Right. Well, the game does get harder as you go on. I don't know what difficulty you're playing on.
I'm on normal right now.
Mm. At some point, the game did become more of a challenge to just get through. And I was pretty satisfied just seeing the ending, you know, with one character. And I might have, I think I saw the ending with both characters. It's the same story. It's the same ending. But the game does encourage you to go through with both characters because they've got slightly different abilities.
Okay. I tried out the girl for, you know, one level, just to see how differently she played. But then I did notice that when you go back to stage select, you know, when you come back to the game, yeah, it only lets you continue with the person that you started with. So you can't just swap back and forth between the two characters. No. So I was wondering what the reason was for that. You say the ending is the same, but does it just encourage you because their play style is different, or what's the reason?
Yeah, their play style is different. And when you go through the game on the same file with both characters, you do unlock a mode where you can switch between them, I believe.
Okay.
Instantly. Oh, and, yeah, the slight difference between them, I think, mostly has to do with the way that their lock-on works, their charge shots.
Right.
So, yeah, I guess you can play with that to try to get higher scores.
Yeah.
I haven't really played it as a, score attack game.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think if it were, if, you know, the Wii online community were such that, it was possible for everyone who had the game, you know, say just in a community like even Negative World where they, were like constantly reminded like, oh, so and so has beaten your score, then maybe that might make it a little more appealing. But like, you know, you beat the level and it says, do you want to upload this score to the leaderboard? And I'm like, fine. It doesn't really matter. You know, like this is, it's 10 seconds of my life wasted basically. But the game, you know, aside from what mild disappointments about the plot that I may have right now, and again, you know, we'll wait and see how it plays out over the entirety of the game. But, just, you know, for what it is, for the gameplay, I mean, it is fun, and I am certainly excited to see, you know, what the next crazy excuse for a boss with like a, you know, penguin head and the body of a broom or something is gonna be, so. Yep. Yeah, I think that's all I have to say. I mean, I love the controls. I will say I love the controls. I love having, you know, a pointer, and, you know, I'm sure you could obviously pull this off with dual analog sticks, but, I'm just really enjoying the Wiimote and Nunchuck.
Yeah, both options are there, so you can test it for yourself. But yeah, I agree. The controls, the pointer and Nunchuck controls really made the game for me.
Yeah. Definitely.
But yeah, like stick a classic controller in there, try dual analog, and yeah, you'll probably switch back very quickly.
Sure. But that's it for me. So, Steven, what about you? What have you been playing?
Okay, so anyone who listened to the last episode knows that I really loved BioShock, which is not a Nintendo game, but it's still, you know, one of the best non-Nintendo games I've ever played. And so when I bought the game, I had bought BioShock 2 right with it. And even though both were my Shocktober games, or as you earlier before we recorded called them, Bioshocktober games.
That's right.
Which I thought was clever. But
it's very clever.
So I had been playing them. I beat the first one before Shocktober began, but I was working on the second one during the first couple weeks of October here, and it was pretty awesome. It's a lot more of the same. It's you go back to Rapture, the underwater city, and it's a lot of first person shooting and not so much puzzle solving per se, but just it's kind of like the enemies themselves can become puzzles, but it's not too heavy on puzzles. It's a lot of just kind of exploring and occasionally shooting the enemy here and there. So in a way, I guess it's a little more like, it's like Metroid without the puzzles.
Like immerse yourself in the world, basically.
Yeah. I mean, and as I explained with the first game, there's just tons of audio diaries for you to pick up, and you just hear these people talk in little snippets about what's been going on, and it's very creepy, it's very atmospheric. That's pretty much the biggest selling point of the whole series for me, is that kind of atmosphere and how deep you just kind of care. Like, I think I said this last time, but I constantly find myself with my head tilted up, my body slunched forward, and my mouth a little open. You know, just just kind of like playing, like excited, and I have to catch myself. But the second one is a separate story in the same place, but a different year, but kind of the same general thing. So you don't continue the first game per se. You continue the kind of concepts that are established in the first game, but you don't continue from a character's point of view. And I found it to be really fun. You do play as a Big Daddy, which is an enemy from the first game, although I wouldn't really call them enemies so much because even though you do fight them, they're not necessarily bad people or bad things. But again,
they're just kind of like guardians, aren't they?
Yeah.
Like, they're just, like, doing their job.
Yeah, exactly. So you end up playing as one of them, and that's part of the storyline of the second one. And so for that fact, instead of having a fist to punch, you actually have a drill as a hand. And that kind of is pretty interesting. And you kind of move differently because you're kind of in this heavy scuba suit. And so it felt a little different upon starting. I even feel like the contrast was a little different. Like, I felt like it was darker, you know? And one of the cool things that is kind of an upgrade from the first game was that in the first game you had to switch between a plasmid, which is, you know, the telekinesis or, like, fire and just the kind of magical power stuff, and then switch between that and shooting. You cannot do both at the same time, but now you can in Bioshock 2. And so it really makes for interesting battles, especially in the heat of everything. You know, you freeze this guy, you shoot him with a missile, and then you call a robot security drone to come in and finish the job, you know? And you can do all that pretty quickly, and the battles get really intense. I feel like the difficulty itself is pretty much ramped up. You know, more enemies at a time. Not in kind of a annoying way, though. It just kind of makes sense. I guess in this game, because of who the main enemy is, the other kind of random, you know, drug addicts or whoever the heck you're fighting, the splicers, they just hate you. Well, in the first game, they were kind of indifferent, just kind of living their lives as well. But then they were like a drug addict might, they kind of got jealous of you if they thought you were going to go after what they wanted. In this one, they kind of know to go after you in the first place. So, I mean, it pretty much, Bioshock 2 is pretty much a slightly more challenging, kind of side version of Bioshock 1. Still totally great to play. There's some new additions as far as the, plasmids go or the weapons. And I know that it's not on a Nintendo console, but I really would encourage people to try to play it if they get a chance. And Bioshock Infinite, which is the third in the series, and I'm not sure if it's planned to be something beyond a trilogy, but the third installment's coming out later next year. I think in the first couple months it's planned, like February or something. So not too far away, but there's no plans, you know, announced currently for a Wii U version, but I would totally love to get it on the Wii U and support Nintendo, but I think it might have to be my next Xbox game, which there haven't been many, but I pretty much have to play this however I can. And the third game actually is supposed to take place in a sky city as opposed to under the water, so I'm very intrigued by that as well.
Couple quick questions.
Yeah, please.
So I know that the first one is all underwater. Mm-hmm. Do you actually like swim? Like, especially in the second one where you've got that scuba suit, right? Is there other parts that take place actually in the water?
That's actually a very good point. In the first game, no. you know, anything with you in the water is cutscenes, with the exception of, like, you know, wading up to your knees kind of thing, you know, or ducking through a small little river that's somewhere.
Or the very opening of the game where you're swimming in the wreckage.
Right. So, yeah, in the beginning of the first game, you crash, and then you kind of discover this little lighthouse, which leads you to the underwater city, and a lot of water there. But you never actually end up in the water in the first game. In the second one, though, it's more of a story-driven moment, and there's a few of them. But yeah, you do end up under the water, but you can't be hurt under the water. There's no enemies under the water. You just kind of move around. And again, they're not like big areas. They're not frustrating. There's no really horrible swimming mechanics. You don't even actually swim. You just kind of, because you're so heavy, you sink to the bottom and you just kind of walk along the ocean floor. And there are a couple things here and there to collect, maybe on your little travels, but it's kind of a way to logically, through the story, separate certain areas and make it so you can't go back.
Sure.
Like, you know, maybe one area ends up getting some water in it that prevents you from going back there. And so, yeah, it's more of a story thing, but there are some underwater sequences. And some of them are pretty cool. And I do like that they kind of spend a little bit of time outside the water, or outside of the city, in the water. It was kind of nice.
So I haven't played either of these games, though I think I would probably love them. And someday I hope to, even if it means, you know, not on a Nintendo platform. But from what I saw, again, it seemed like the Big Daddies were kind of like, I don't know if mindless is the right word, but sort of like drones, you know? So when you are controlling it then in the second game, I guess what is the sort of like what pushes him forward? Yeah, right. Because if he's just, you know, guarding, don't they guard the little girls or something like that?
Yeah, okay. The little sisters.
Right. So if he's just guarding her, wouldn't that be like mission accomplished and then go home?
It would if your little sister was with you.
Okay.
But the one that you're bonded with, and
she's in another castle.
Yeah, pretty much. Your little sister's in another castle. More or less, yeah. That's kind of the thing there is a little bit of an amnesia type thing where you don't even know why you're in a Big Daddy suit and why you are a Big Daddy. Because a Big Daddy is a human being who's kind of volunteered to become a Big Daddy. And in the first game, some of the lore kind of explains that once you become one, you can't undo it. But the second one kind of makes it feel like they are more human inside. And maybe it is just kind of like wearing a suit. But there is a motivation with you and the little sister you're connected to, who, you know, has a name, and it's a deeper story, but you do actually go around kind of stealing other little sisters, because you still need the atom, which is the kind of life essence that people have in this world. And of course, just like the first game, you can harvest the little sisters when you catch them, or when you get their trust, which would kill them by taking all the atom out of them, or you can take most of it and leave some with them, which would kind of cure them from their kind of zombie brainwashing thing. Because little sisters are generally brainwashed to kind of go hunt dead bodies for Adam so they can kind of milk it out of them. And so, you know, in the second one, I continued to rescue, being a bit of a humanitarian for little sisters. But to get this Adam from little sisters, you have to effectively kill the other Big Daddies who are currently guarding them. So then you can then adopt them. So it is kind of weird, because it's like, if you're a human being who has like a heart and a conscious mind, well, why doesn't that guy, you know,
right?
Or does he? And I just don't care, you know? So
sure.
I guess they just don't expect you to think too deeply about that, because they flesh you out so much. And, but then there's also an argument to say that maybe the other Big Daddies just simply aren't that cognitively aware at that point.
Yeah. You're the chosen one.
Kind of. Yeah. So that's kind of how they play it off in that. There is a primary goal, a primary enemy. Like in the first game, there's kind of this disembodied voice who actually does have a body, but you don't really get to meet them until later in the game. But they kind of help you out. So the traditional kind of pieces are there.
Last question.
Yeah.
So if you beat the game in a certain amount of time, do you see your character without their suit and you find out it's a woman and it wasn't a Big Daddy? It was a Big Mama.
A Big Mama.
Named Samus.
You know what? No.
Oh, okay.
No, unless you're playing Metroid. But there are a new type of sisters, though. There's something called the Big Sister. So, you know, you have the little sister that you rescue, but then there's Big Sisters, which pretty much are people who are designed to kick your ass. Because you're designed to kick other people's asses to protect the little sister. Well, they're designed to kick your ass to protect the little sister. And that's because the antagonists of this game doesn't like you very much.
they never do.
Yeah, no. So, but you know, I do want to say that the atmosphere is really all there still, and it's still fun going back, especially back to back like that. You really stay immersed in this kind of messed up kind of version of the 1950s. And even though the main character who designed the whole city isn't an active role in the second game, they still have quite a presence. And there is a bit of a link between the games, just not the stories themselves. If you look on Wikipedia and you like kind of read through the whole history of the timeline of what the games are supposed to be, you'll see that there's distinct separations. And actually, I haven't played the multiplayer in this game, which the second one does have multiplayer, and apparently it's a pretty deep section of the game. But it itself is its own storyline, the multiplayer is, which is kind of crazy.
That's a nice bonus, I guess.
Yeah. And we'll maybe get into this with Guillaume's topic, but I don't currently really have anyone to play that with, so it's kind of a moot set of data on the disc. But even so, the single player is well worth the purchase. It was pretty awesome.
Cool.
And real quick, I guess I'll mention the other game I've been playing, which is Pokemon Black 2. I had Pokemon White, and I figured let's just swap it for the sequel. And I haven't linked it to Pokemon White, so I haven't kind of received the bonuses of doing that sort of thing. But I mean, it's Pokemon, which not to say that lightly either. It's I played Pokemon for the first time in eighth grade, and I still effing love it. You know, I certainly don't want to catch them all anymore because that's too damn excruciating to do. But this game apparently makes it easier to do that, and I haven't spent much time with it, but they now have habitat lists for the different routes, so you can see what Pokemon are available, and there's a little checklist of, like, you've caught this one, this one, this one. So it actually allows you to kind of be more of a completionist and make it a little bit easier to do that.
I've seen that for this game they have some Pokemon that are from previous generations, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Which, if my memory from my almost 200 hours of Pokemon White serves correctly... was not the case, correct? I can't believe I don't remember, but you could only get Gen 5 Pokemon in Black and White,
until
correct?
You complete the main game. And then that unlocked a bunch of other Pokemon you apparently just walked right past. Because there's no, like, you don't beat the game and then suddenly, you know, your main character, like, opens the door to some zoo cage and lets out a bunch of, you know, other generation Pokemon.
Okay.
But in this game, it just kind of populates it with all sorts of... you know, Pokemon from all the generations. Okay. Currently, my team, I honestly can't remember everyone in it. I have a Koffing in there right now. You know, he's from Generation 1. And then I've got, like, a Mareep, which is the electric sheep from, like, the second or third generation.
Mm-hmm.
Who else? I have a Growthy, who totally replaced my Tepig. By the way, I feel like a fool saying all these names out loud.
That's cool, man.
Like, I've never really done that all at once before. I've thought them, but I've never really spoke them.
Have you? Did you ever see the Presidents of the United States of America, the music video for Pokemon Black and White?
No.
Where they go through and say every Pokemon name. Everyone should look it up after this. It's kind of funny.
Okay, interesting.
And it's kind of good.
Presidents of the United States, you said?
Yeah, did you ever hear them? They had that song Lump in the 90s.
I mean, I did back in the day. I don't quite recall.
Yeah. Anyway.
But yeah, so I've got, you know, a pretty healthy mix of you know, old and new Pokemon. And there's a whole slew of them that I want to catch. But, you know, I don't need three electric Pokemon on my team right now. But they give you the option. There's a lot of variety right from the get-go, which feels a bit different than past games. Particularly because, you know, whatever the first gym is, they kind of don't want you to be too strong against that, right? So... they prevent you from getting, like, that type of Pokemon that would be strong against them in the beginning. Mm-hmm. But here they kind of just give you the choice. And I think that's the best way to do it, because if, you know, say it was a fire gym, well, you know what, I should have the right to use either a leaf Pokemon or grass Pokemon or a water Pokemon. I should be able to play the game how I want to play. I think it doesn't add much to force me to use a grass Pokemon, you know.
Right.
So it's cool. It's exciting, particularly because you have five generations of Pokemon, and you don't really know what to expect anymore. With Black and White, the originals in this series, you knew you were getting just the fresh new Pokemon. There's no chance of a Dratini in the water kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And here you have no idea.
I'm assuming you still cannot in this game, like, catch every single one in the series, right?
I mean,
you can probably trade them in.
I certainly don't know that by, you know, experience, okay. But from what I've read, that is not the case. Yeah, you can't. I think there's up to like 300 Pokemon in this game, which is quite short considering there's, what, 500 to 600 in the whole
thing? Something like that, yeah.
So, you know, who knows, I guess, what they're going for. I downloaded the Dream Radar last night and played it for 2 seconds, which is pretty much how long it takes to play. And then there's 21 Pokemon to unlock there, and they're rarer ones, and you can easily send it to your copy of the game, which is actually really nice. That's pretty painless. So, you know, I give it points for that. I don't know.
Like, I was surprised, because I looked into that last night, and I don't know, I thought it might be fun, and I thought it, because I think someone posted in the Pokemon thread on the forums that they got, like, a bunch of legendaries to start off their adventure, and I think it might have been you that asked, like, how did you do that? And they said, oh, the Dream Raider.
So I looked into it. Actually,
makes sense.
Who has those? Yeah.
So I looked into it, and I was pretty much just ready to go and get it, but if you can only get like 21 Pokemon, I mean,
well, in the materials for it, it says currently
21. Okay.
So there is, I guess, that small little incentive of possibly expanding it. Who knows if Nintendo will get off their asses and do that. You know, I don't know what they're planning, but currently 21, but there are no slouches. It's not like you're going to get like a Magikarp, you know?
Sure.
There's three different forms of, or new forms of those three weather Pokemon, which are pretty rare.
Right.
And you should be able to get those pretty easily, I guess, through this game. I mean, that's pretty cool. Cause those.
And I think on this one, it's all hidden abilities, right? Which are the better ones typically.
Right.
So that's a good incentive. I'll probably end up getting it just for a couple bucks, and you know,
I was gonna put on like exactly the amount to get it because it, you know, it'd be like three something with tax. But I was admittedly kind of on the fence. But when I booted up my 3DS last night, I realized I had like four something just sitting there from a previous purchase. So I was like, ah, what the hell? So I just did it, brushed my teeth while it was downloading, and then I tried it for 2 seconds. In fact, I was kind of shooting at Obama and Romney because I was watching the debate at the same time, and. Might have got the moderator in the head. I don't know, but it's fine for $3.
Yeah, and if they ever give any more in the future, I mean, I think that'd be great. I don't think I ever want to get into a system of exchanging money for Pokemon. So if they ever are like, well, here's 5 more for $1.50.
Sure. Oh, I wouldn't do that either. This has some sort of gameplay to do and everything. And admittedly, that crossed my mind. I kind of was concerned, like, am I just buying Pokemon at this point? Which is Pokemon I'm probably never going to use. I mean,
Just on principle, that sits weird with me. So.
Yeah. But I mean, it's pretty much Face Raiders with Pokemon.
Right.
And instead of, you know, hilarious mouth movements and you know, face animations, it's just Pokemon. So, I mean, it's the gameplay with Pokemon. You get some stuff.
So then do you have to, like, wait for them to appear, or is it just, like, 21 right in succession?
Oh, no. You have to do, like, you have to kind of shoot at different clouds and stuff, up to, like, 5 to 7, maybe, clouds. And then when you do that, you kind of get an opportunity to get a Pokemon, and I think it's random. And, and then at that point, I think it takes, like, 5 minutes per cloud to, like, regenerate, so you can only play, technically, like, once every hour, maybe. So you kind of, it does kind of force you to wait, as Nintendo likes to do.
Mm. And you don't, like, it doesn't take into account anything, like, any furniture in your house, right? I mean, like, it's not going to place, okay, like, this is a Pokemon that walks on the ground, so the cloud is going to be on your table, you know? They're just floating around.
I think that's the case. It doesn't use any cards to kind of solidify it as a stable object. And, my first Pokemon I caught last night was I think it's called a Munna. It's kind of like a pink piggy looking thing. It's kind of like a dream. I don't know. I guess I would assume that it walks on the ground, but it was flying through the air, you know?
No, I think that one floats.
Does it? Okay.
Yeah.
So who knows? Maybe so far, all I know is that those three, weather Pokemon and then this floaty one. So maybe they're all just floating Pokemon just to kind of have that logic there. I don't know.
Wow, that would show surprising, you know, care from Nintendo about logic and,
If I get a Drifloon, I guess I'll be more convinced that that's the case. But again, if I see a Magikarp, I'm probably going to, like, write Nintendo for my money back.
Hopefully you don't have to worry about that.
No. But yeah, so all in all, Pokemon's been fun so far. The new one and this Dream Radar is a fine supplement, you know. But we have a lot more Pokemon to talk about with your topic, so let's move on to what do you think? we're going to do a quick what do you think section before jumping into our meat and potatoes topics. First, it was announced today that Scribblenauts Wii U is going to include Mario and Zelda universe characters and items. So you can expect seeing, you know, Yoshi, Epona, maybe even Mario Karts, that kind of thing. Does this change your opinions of the game, whether or not you were going to get it before and you really want to now, or you weren't interested and you are, or you could care less? I just want to know what you guys think.
Yeah, it did change my opinion. I was interested before, and I don't want anything to do with it.
Ah.
No, I'm kidding. But, yeah, like, it doesn't really... I think that the novelty would wear out quick. But I was already kind of interested in the game, just maybe not $60 interested.
Sure.
So we'll see. But, yeah, from what I had played of the demo at E3, I really liked the idea. It was my first time playing Scribblenauts, so the whole novelty was there for me. So, yeah, don't put too much stock in what I'm saying. If you've played Scribblenauts before and got sick of it, I'm not at that stage yet. But
well, yeah, and that's kind of where I'm at, because I played the first one and I liked it enough, but it did kind of get cumbersome. And you kind of, like everyone was complaining about, you use the same items and everything. I feel like with the Mario and Zelda thing, that might be really cool, but I'll probably end up using Mario Karts instead of trucks every time. Or, you know, the Link sword instead of scissors, you know. So right. Eventually it would still kind of wear off as quickly, and I am concerned, especially at the $60 price point. So it doesn't really change my opinion too much. Joe?
This was second only to New Super Mario Bros. U as far as Wii U games that I really wanted. I'm not more excited about the game because of this. I'm sure it'll be fine. I'm sure it'll be a cute little novelty, but there is a small part of me that is like, can't we try to sell a game without Mario?
Right. That is a complaint you hear a lot, you know?
Yeah. So from that perspective, I kind of, I don't know. It doesn't really help the case, but I'm still super excited about the game itself.
Okay. And then next, I wanted to ask you guys, Zombie U apparently has some really cool, multiplayer modes that are going to be a part of the game. Recently we learned about Time Attack, which is kind of, kill as many zombies as possible and, you know, until you die or whatever, until the time runs out. Then there's Survival, which is kind of staying alive as long as you can. But then Zombie King seems pretty interesting, which is pretty much, you have one character kind of going through a level, and then you have another person who acts as the Zombie King, who can actually send little hordes of up to like 8 zombies, kind of, okay, you know, around that corner, because they think you're going to go over there, and they get to watch you like God, and that seems pretty cool to me. I don't know if you guys are kind of excited for that kind of gameplay in Zombie U, if you think that that's something fresh with the asymmetric push that they're trying to do Nintendo.
Yeah, I guess so. On the PC, I played a lot of Left 4 Dead 2 with friends. And this, you know, is another zombie game, but it looks different enough. And yeah, like this mode seems to be one-on-one. And yeah, like as long as it offers a different experience, sure, I'm interested. It's just going to be perhaps a challenge to find people to play with.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, the Zombie King mode sounds like a ton of fun. I'm sure I would really enjoy it. It's the kind of thing that I envisioned when they first started talking about using the gamepad for asymmetric multiplayer. But I just am concerned at how readily I'll be able to find people to enjoy that mode with. So,
but at least, you know, in comparison with your Zelda discussion, you know, that's 4 swords, 4 players. At least it's only, you know, you and one other person, which should be at least a little bit easier. But
true.
Still has the same kind of issues, though, that we'll be getting into with Guillaume's topic.
Indeed.
My quick thoughts, though, on it are, it kind of reminds me of something that I might mention in my actual topic, but in Time Splitters, my cousin and I did a lot of just kind of going after each other, you know, having teams, but kind of really trying to hunt each other down. And, of course, we couldn't see, like, in an omnipotent way, the map, but you could still kind of, you could look at the other person's screen and see where they were at and kind of just go hunt them down. This kind of brings back memories of that, and I think Zombie King might be one of my new favorite multiplayer experiences. Time will tell. So lastly, I just wanted to ask you guys, with November being so packed with game releases, both, you know, Wii U, 3DS, etc., just, you know, I just wanted to hear really quick what couple you're really, really excited for. What are you most anticipating?
Well, I'm I've made a resolution recently, and I'm keeping to it so far, not to buy games that I don't plan on playing immediately.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Even if I see a sale. So I've passed on games for ridiculous prices because, when am I going to find the time to play this? I'm only looking to two or three games at most. I'm getting Nintendo Land.
Mm-hmm.
And since that's not really a title that you can really get through, then I'm going to get Mario at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And if I somehow, crave another game, if I finish Mario quickly enough, I'm probably going to get Epic Mickey on the 3DS.
Okay, great.
Did you have a positive experience with the Wii game?
I have not played the Wii game. Well, actually, no, that's not true. I played maybe the first level of the Wii game. And it seemed cool enough, but I read the impressions of other people. I know the game has its problems. And yeah, I listened to this podcast as well. So I'm plainly aware that it was unpolished.
Sure.
But
I think that the 3DS version, or that that game should have all of the charm with none of the headaches, though. So
yeah, well, it's a completely different kind of game. I mean, it's more of a sequel to Castle of Illusion on the Sega Genesis. So, we'll see. But yeah, I just love 2D platformers. So, I will probably get this.
True.
And Joe?
I'm going to be buying one game in a couple days, which is not November. I'm going to be buying Virtue's Last Reward, for 3DS. That's the sequel to 999.
Mm-hmm.
And, after that, I'm going on monetary lockdown, and just everything else is going to be going on the Christmas list because I can't afford to buy games.
Oh.
I'll be ignoring all the cool stuff that comes out in November.
So in other words, we need to be helping Joe get a game or two this November. All the users.
We'll start a Kickstarter.
To the Kickstarter.
Well, hopefully, you can put away $5 for the inevitable Secret Santa. That will do.
Yeah, I mean, I think by the time December 25th rolls around, I'm sure I'll have enough to, the games from November won't go bad. So.
Oh, no. I'm pretty sure that, you want to play games to some extent. I mean, you want to play them in general, but it's nice to play with a bunch of your friends, like on Negative World. It's nice to play a game when it's fresh because we're all doing it. But
yeah.
I'm pretty sure that these launch games are going to be fresh well into December and beyond.
You know, to that point, I wasn't really planning on getting Pokemon Black or White 2, but mm-hmm. there's just been so much, activity on the
forum
that I'm going to put it on my Christmas list, and hopefully by the end of December, people will still be as active with it. So.
I probably won't be. Although, you know what? Actually, that's a lie.
Son of a bitch.
Well, I mean, there's going to be so much to play, but I don't know if I'm going to beat it in time, so I might still be trying to work my way through it, but you can count on me for trading and battling, though.
Yeah. Well, we'll catch up again in March or something when nothing is coming out or whatever.
Just to answer my own question real quick, I guess Paper Mario for the 3DS, I'm really uber psyched for, and
looks good.
Yeah, there's a video, 34-minute video apparently now on Go Nintendo or something, and I'm refusing to look at it, but I'm so tempted.
Nintendo World Report actually, but it was pulled down on Nintendo's request.
Really?
Unfortunately, yeah.
Hmm.
Oh.
They don't allow you to. They usually don't want videos longer than 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Gameplay footage of their games, and they require you to show the hands of the person playing at all times. So people try to get around that, but they keep an eye on that kind of thing.
Well, then that solves my problem. So there's that, and then of course, I've already gone into detail before on the podcast of all the Wii U games, but I'm really just psyched for the new Mario. And I liked the new 3DS Mario, but I think the Wii U version is going to be just incredible. So yeah, that's what I'm excited for. That's what you guys are excited for, and we're excited to talk about our main topics. So we'll take a quick break, and we'll get into that. We'll be right back.
Well, my topic is local multiplayer. I just want to talk about this because I've been doing some local multiplayer recently, mostly with my girlfriend. But yeah, usually on podcasts, when people start talking about local multiplayer, they usually just keep saying how they don't have time for it or they don't have the people for it around them. And, you know, like mostly they have to rely on online multiplayer because everyone is so far away and everything. But I'd like us to try to avoid talking, you know, dwelling too much about that and perhaps just talk about, you know, what makes a good local multiplayer experience for us or, you know, our favorite memories or our favorite games. So yeah, like, let me ask you the questions, you know, to you guys first. What makes a good local multiplayer?
Joe, you want to take this first, or?
Sure. I guess probably the first thing would be, the kind of experience that doesn't take a lot of explaining.
Yes.
I think it's, you know, it's always good when, you know, everyone can just sort of jump right in and start having fun as opposed to having the first 15 minutes be like, all right, well, you push this to open your map and then, you know. And probably next, as much as it might sound like a sort of a cheap reason, just the kind of game that makes people laugh. I mean, that's why I think, you know, Mario Kart and, well, also that, I mean, the reason why that works so well is because, you know, someone just randomly explodes from a blue shell or something. And, you know, it's just goofy and it's fun and people start laughing. And the same thing when I played, New Super Mario Brothers Wii with four people. So, you know, of the insanity when you start accidentally bouncing on other people's heads and sending them into lava and, you know, the shame of realizing that all four of you have hit the A button to go into a bubble at the same time, you know, things like that for right. me.
And what about you, Steven?
Well, definitely, I completely agree with Joe's comments. You know, as you talk about that, your two suggestions, I think about like the NES and the Super Nintendo and how those, you know, had very simple, you know, jump in and play things. They kind of had to because they were so basic, but that kind of agrees with itself and with what you're saying. For me, I guess the first thing that comes to mind is being able to be on an equal playing field. You know, like, I mean, I know that people can get better at games than others and that kind of thing, but like in Mario Kart, the blue shell, as annoying as it is, does help kind of even things out. And to me, good local multiplayer is not about constantly owning the other person because that's not fun for them and that then won't be fun for you. You want to be able to both be able to kind of win, lose, and just have a lot of fun doing it. Have that competitive spirit without actually crushing anyone's soul. And so a good local multiplayer game for me includes that. Mario Party was kind of an example of that. Like, my cousin, he kicked my ass at button mashing games. But when it came to other kind of games, I would wipe the floor with them. So we kind of had our own little favorites, and we'd kind of almost fight to try to play a certain mini game. You know, when the little roulette went, we would kind of root for something and, oh, shoot, I know he's going to have an edge here, but I'll get an edge next time, you know. So having that even playing field, I think, is really important.
Well, you guys both touched on basically everything I wanted to say. Like, this is pretty cool. What I'm about to say is not really a hard set rule. Of course, there are exceptions, but I think that in general, if I'm only playing with one other person, I prefer a co-op game because essentially of what you, Steven, said, being on an equal playing field, you know? Because when there's only two of you, then you're competing directly. And if one is not at the same level as the other one, then it's always going to be the same person winning and the same person losing. Right. And that's not fun for either person, usually.
Yeah. Unless one person's a jerk.
Yeah. But, so yeah, like I think that a co-op experience when there's only two of you is preferable because then it doesn't really matter the skill level. I mean, usually you're going to have one person who owns the game, who knows it better, and who can guide the other one through the experience.
And
so
in a kind of similar way, if there's like say a four-player multiplayer, I always kind of like the team battles because you kind of it's kind of like a co-op but still versus, you know. Like I
That's
think about
true.
GoldenEye a lot with that.
Yeah. Yeah, and when I do like competitive modes better when there's more than two people. When there's three or four or five with the Wii U, then there is more opportunities for other people to win, other people to lose. Mm-hmm. And even if there's a wide gap of, you know, in terms of skills, like you said, sometimes you can team up the best player and the worst, or things like that. So that makes it a little bit more fun for everyone. Mm-hmm. That's basically all I had to say. I do also agree with Joe that the game being easy to understand, to like very, very pick up and play, is really, really important. Because there are two examples that I can think of recently. Like I tried to get into Lara Croft and the Guardian of Light, which is an XBLA PSN game, with someone. And also the Bionic Commando game, the remake, also on PSN and XBLA. Both of those games have surprising complexity. You know, like they kind of use more buttons in the controller than they should, in my opinion. And they're also, like, their structure, the structure of Bionic Commando is really kind of a maze. So you have to look for things and, you know, follow the story and... it's a little bit too complex to just like, okay, to tell buddy, okay, grab the controller. We're going to get through this game. If they've never picked it up before, you know, it's not like Contra. You can't just, you know, like you don't instantly
shoot at the moving things.
Yeah. You don't instantly know where you're supposed to go. Just go right. Keep going right. And, you know, that's all you have to do. So yeah, like the simplicity is really important. And in the case of Lara Croft, yeah, like I think that there's a lot of complexity that isn't really necessary. The game is mostly about exploring the environments and solving puzzles, but they've also put this twin stick shooter element to it, where you're constantly being attacked by creatures, and so like you're constantly interrupted. You have to do some combat and then go back to trying to solve this puzzle. And the combat is so an afterthought, in my opinion, in that game. But still, they decided that it was worth complexifying the game by adding different weapons and giving you, like, basically giving you, unlocking what different kinds of weapons to try to spice up the combat, when, in my opinion, like, they should have kept it as simple as possible. And there are tutorials after tutorials interrupting you as you play through the first two levels of the game. So I really think they could have spared us a couple of tutorials just by, you know, not bothering with...
just streamline the whole experience a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. Like the whole hold the L2 trigger and press one of the face buttons to select your new rifle. I could have done without. You didn't need the rifle in the first place. So that's basically my opinion on what makes a good multiplayer experience. Are there games that you guys really think back fondly? Maybe I'll go first. It's really strange, but I bought Baseball Stars 2 on the Virtual Console, which is this baseball Neo Geo game, and I bought it specifically because of... I don't even like baseball. I don't watch it on TV. I've never played it in real life, really, except for, you know, like one or two games occasionally. But I have very fond memories of just, you know, sitting with a friend and, you know, just talking while playing Ken Griffey Jr. Baseball on the SNES. Or more recently, one of my roommates had a Dreamcast that was, you know, like he emulated some NES games, and we played RBI baseball on the thing while we were talking about, I don't know, girls or whatever. So, really, really, really fond memories of that. But unfortunately, Baseball Stars 2, like it's the very first channel that shows up when I load up my SD card. And so it's the one game that everyone that I've ever shown my collection to sees. And the channel itself is very, very, you know, like the whole channel is green. It's very, very striking. So there's no way you can miss it. And yet, you know, like there's never, ever been anyone that I've shown my games to who said like, hey, you know, what's that baseball game? We should play it. So I never really got the chance to play co-op and, or what am I saying? Not co-op, but, you know, play against someone, against a human opponent. So I'd like to at some point, but it seems like that kind of experience perhaps is in the past for me.
I've kind of mentioned most of my fondest memories already somewhere in this podcast. I mean, Mario Party, the first one, and I think even two, I think were big ones for me. But Time Splitters, which I'll mention again later, that is one of the most played and addictive multiplayer experiences, that I've ever experienced ever. Just something about, you know, the hunt and all the different customization things, like me and my cousin, we just ate that up constantly, even though there was one particular map, which was this kind of ice, kind of, just open space, just tundra, I guess. And we would just pick sniper rifles and the Jeep, and we would just go around trying to snipe each other and then trying to drive up and then get a quick hit and drive away. And it was just so goofy that it was just ridiculous. Like, it didn't matter how bad of a day we were having. If we got together to play that, then, you know, all of our worries were washed away. And Perfect Dark was kind of like that as well, beforehand. We were pretty much just barely post-pubescent at that age. And, so we, you know, would also complain about girls and just like, oh, that guy's such an asshole at school, you know, that kind of thing. Sitting there playing, Perfect Dark and trying to fight the evil Sims or doing some co-op levels and stuff. First-person shooters, I guess, for me, have been kind of really good for that. The only, I guess, other two that come to mind right now is, Dr. Mario has been, excellent two-player kind of local multiplayer experience since I first owned it when I was really, really young. And, to this day, I still, you know, am always ready to go play that with somebody. And then I guess a more recent title would be, Boom Blocks is really cool. It's very relaxing and just kind of chill. And again, it kind of makes you laugh to, you know, try to fling a ball into a tower and end up missing and hitting that pig character and he just flies off hilariously. Or, I guess that touches on what Joe was saying, is that my favorite experiences have been ones where I could just laugh, you know?
Yeah.
I'm not someone who gets a lot of gratification, I suppose, out of like, okay, we can really do this. We can team together and we can totally annihilate this problem or this task. It's more like, let's just relax and enjoy ourselves, you know?
Yeah. I will just bring up, I graduated in May and my family came over and, you know, we had a party and my family said, like, because I didn't really want to have a party. I didn't want to make a big deal. I just wanted to, like, I didn't even want to walk across the stage, honestly. I just wanted to, like, get the thing in the mail later. But so they said, you know, no, it's a big deal. You know, PhD, we're having this party. So as sort of a compromise, they said, at the party, we can do whatever you want. Okay. So so this meant that. We played a little Mario Party with my family. And,
the Wii one?
Six? No, it was, GameCube.
Yeah, 4, 5, and 6, I think were GameCube ones.
Yeah, so I think it was 6. But, you know, it was good because I had, you know, my sister who, she used to, back in the day, she would like steal my copies of, the original Dragon Warrior and Super Mario Land. And that was pretty much the entirety of her gaming up until, Wii Fit came out. And then she played that and loved that. And so that's her as a gamer. And then there was her husband who is total like, Team Fortress 2 and, Fallout 3. And, you know, he's not against the Wii or what Nintendo does, but he just doesn't happen to really enjoy that stuff as much. And his son, which is the same way. And then there was like, you know, my aunt and uncles and my parents and obviously my wife was playing with us. And so we just had like all these different walks of life and the content in a Mario Party game is such that, you know, anyone can appreciate what's going on and everyone understands that, you know, when the big rock falls on your character and you get booted off the screen or something, that that's a bad thing and that that's comical. And, you know, so it was just a really good time. And, you know, it didn't last super long. I wasn't good after the first couple of games, you know, I could tell they were starting to get a little bored of it. I wasn't going to force them against their will, but it was just a really good time.
Cool.
So it sounds like you're left with a lot of warm fuzzies by this experience. And that's kind of goes to what you're saying is.
Yeah, definitely.
What you like most out of those kind of experiences.
Yeah, because that day would have just been, without that part of it, it would have just been like, I would have felt like I was just sort of suffering through it, you know, like a, like a zoo animal on display or something. So that was fun.
Or imagine, you know, the exact same moments, but over the internet, your mom being, you know, far away, just in front of her TV and, yeah, I don't know. There's a certain thing about local multiplayer that you just can't replicate.
Absolutely. I mean, Nintendo clearly doesn't really embrace online the way a lot of other companies do and the way that they could. And, you know, I'm going to talk about that a little bit in the Pokemon topic, but yeah, there's no doubt. Like, I can't remember. I think it was Mario Party 9 that when it came out and people were like, oh, why isn't this online? Right. Wasn't that the game where people were?
Yeah. I mean, I was wondering that personally.
Yeah. Well, again, it's nice to have the option, but it truly is never going to be the same experience. And that's not the intended experience.
Well, like you were saying that, you know, you were kind of feeling warm feelings while playing with your family and such, you know. And when I got Mario Party 9, like I was playing with my girlfriend and it was like a very nice bonding moment with her, you know. And we played it multiple times, multiple days, and each time it just felt like another kind of nice bonding moment. It was very, you know, touching and sweet or whatever. And I really can't imagine getting that same kind of feeling. Like the fun would be there, but the bonding wouldn't be there.
Sure.
You know, and that's important for me, especially considering gaming is a major way I try to bond with people, hence Negative World and my involvement in it, you know. I don't really have that many other hobbies where I try to do it with other people. So having that kind of connection that you can really only get in person really is important to me.
And it's funny when I think about how much Nintendo's marketing changed in the last generation to, you know, this idea of, well, you don't even show the game, you show the people playing it, right? So when I think of that day, you know, I don't think of necessarily the one moment in the game or anything. I think of
or something.
Right. Yeah. I think of the whole family sprawled across the couch in the futon, you know? So.
Well, it's like they say, you know, the best gifts aren't tangible, but they're actually events or like experiences. And Nintendo, I really think is trying to give you experiences that, in a different way that online multiplayer gives.
Yep. Yeah, I think that pretty much concludes my topic, actually. Yeah, this was a good discussion.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's a shame it couldn't have happened in person.
Indeed. Over a beer. A beer cast.
Is this really an officially co-op, podcast, or is it, you know, is it counter-op? I don't know. Am I gonna be sabotaged?
No, it's, competitive.
I think I'm working against Steven most of the time.
We're fighting for time. We're fighting for, you know, the achievement system, who had the best topic, who had the best comment, you know, most long-winded, you know.
I know who I'm voting for who was the biggest jerk.
And that can be sarcastic any way you think about it. But yeah, great topic. You know, excellent discussion, guys. We now have Joe's topic.
Sure. Now that I got done saying how awesome Nintendo is, let's talk about...
how shitty they are, right?
Yep. No.
God, I hate them.
Yeah, Nintendo what?
Anyway, all right. So before Black and White 2 was announced, I kind of said to myself, like, I'm not... You know, I love these Pokemon games, but I always want a more... you know, social experience out of them, and the term MMO gets tossed around a lot. And I said to myself I wasn't gonna play another one until they did that, not in like a angry boycott kind of way, just as like, you know, that's the experience I'm looking for. Now, obviously, as I just described, the cyber peer pressure, if you will, of the Negative World forums have made me decide I'm gonna jump in with either Black or White 2, regardless. But,
look, you can't blame us for your weakness.
It's all the voice.
You're like a level 5 Pokemon, you know, if you can't handle, you know, the pressure, then you shouldn't be fighting.
Anyway, so, it kind of, I think all, this topic I think stems from something that you actually said earlier, Stephen, which was convenient for me, which was this idea of when you're going to evaluate a new Pokemon game, this idea of, well, it's Pokemon, you know, I'm sure we all feel each time a new Nintendo game comes out, whether it be Mario or Zelda, there's always that precursor to the review from a lot of places of, well, it's Mario, well, it's Zelda. So of course that means it's good, but there's nothing really new going on, and depending on how much you care about pure freshness versus just enjoyment, you know, that's a good thing or a bad thing. So I was just thinking about some things that the Pokemon series could do that would not necessarily be reinventing the wheel, but could just maybe make it so that when the 3DS one eventually comes out, we don't say, well, it's Pokemon in 3D. So, the first thing is, like, I feel like the battles, we've already talked on this podcast about, like, there's a certain point in a game where you don't need the tutorials anymore, and you just sort of get it. And sometimes the game overstays its welcome in terms of trying to educate you on what's going on, and you just don't need that anymore. I feel like the battles in all the Pokemon games that I've played, they are slowed down to the point where it's like every little thing that happens, nothing can ever be simultaneous. So it's like the battle begins, you see the opponent Pokemon, they maybe do their little animation or something, and then your guy throws the Pokeball, and then your Pokemon comes out, and then there's a little pause while he does his animation, and then they announce whatever weather effects are going on, and then you have a chance to move, and every time you attack, you know, each attack happens individually, and then there's another pause for if there are weather effects, or if there's any sort of status effect that's going on, I think of like, I know it's common in MMOs. I'm going to try to sort of keep that separate because when you say MMO in relation to Pokemon, people get upset. But, Xenoblade was a game where you're controlling you're basically controlling one person, but you've got a, you know, party of three at all times. And it's just, there's constantly, you know, different moves being done by everyone and different status effects being applied to everyone. And it's not, you know, after you play it for a little while, it doesn't become overwhelming anymore. Your eye gets trained to look for, okay, like when this color number is floating above this person's head, it means that that's happening. And so I just felt that in a game like Pokemon, where you, for the most part, have a maximum of what, 3 versus 3, mm-hmm. that could speed up the process by just having things like, you know, like the animations happening simultaneously, and when weather effects take place or status effects take place, you know, that can just happen in almost real time in between the turns. So it's still, you know, it'd still be purely turn-based. There wouldn't be any incentive for rushing or anything, but the actual, events that take place in between the turns would just be, I guess, more condensed or a little more simultaneous.
To me, it seems like the best option for that stuff would be perhaps to let weather effects be constantly displayed, for one, so you never forget that it's raining or that it's snowing. Mm-hmm. And then as far as, I feel like, if you're doing a 2 or a 3-on-3 battle, showing everyone's animation at the same time could shave off a few seconds, and it kind of makes more sense. No Pokemon's going to wait for the Ekans to do his thing before he's going to do his. But I think status effects are really something that could be shortened, like being poisoned or burned, you know.
Right.
Maybe make it so that way, instead of, you know, I mean, because it is a set amount that you lose when you get burned or poisoned. What if it's just constantly draining as you're even thinking of your move, or maybe to a point? I mean, I know that it's turn-based and the action's supposed to stop. I think changing into like more of a Xenoblade thing in terms of the battles might change it too much, but I'm not sure you were even trying to say that, but they could definitely condense it.
Right, and going along with it, you know, when I think part of it is because they give you information sort of drip-fed like one sentence at a time in terms of the text. So they'll say like, yeah, so-and-so attacked with this and it was super effective or whatever. But, you know, meanwhile on that bottom screen, it's literally blank. In I think all of the Pokemon games I've played. Mm-hmm. So I was thinking, you know, couldn't you, like, let's say the action is more, you know, rapid fire. couldn't you just have like a log on the bottom screen so you could look back even three moves ago to see what happened? It would all be there if, for whatever reason, things start happening too quickly for you to comprehend. You know, you could just look down and see, oh, it's because he poisoned me two moves ago or something right. like that.
Maybe using sound effects to a greater degree. I know that they do have distinct sound effects for when something is super effective or, you know, I mean, maybe rely on that more. So instead of it saying, that's super effective or that was weak or whatever.
Right.
You just kind of, there's maybe a visual or an auditory cue that really helps you and you don't need to read the text.
Right. And you have a good point because there is that precedence with the effectiveness.
And so. What really matters? Okay, so if my move, my fire move against the grass Pokemon is super effective, do I need to be told that? I can just watch his bar go way down. I mean, I guess it teaches you, you know, that fire is good against grass, but you should already know that by now.
Right.
Or maybe leave that for the tutorial section, then after the first badge or the first gym, then it just kind of gets omitted.
Yeah, and this is what, you know, I should say, I sort of touched on it, but like, this is all predicated on, I think, having like an advanced mode, like an advanced option where you could just set, like right now you can set the text speed to be faster. So clearly they are aware of some desire for this, but I think, you know, they're afraid they don't want to alienate because a lot of kids play Pokemon and you don't want to turn anyone away because it's overwhelming. So, you know, you don't have to do that. It doesn't even necessarily have to be like, well, after the first area, all of a sudden everything's sped up. I think just if you just had the, you know, just a toggle checkbox to, you know, opt in for this.
Options in a video game, you are wishful thinking, my friend.
Yeah, yeah.
You'd be surprised. I mean, I don't know why more games don't do that. But yeah, it should be a simple option, you'd think.
Yeah, and I know people have talked before, Guillaume, I think I've heard this on RFN a couple times, where people have been like, you know, at the start of a Zelda game or at the start of a Metroid game, there should just be a little question box saying, have you played one of these before?
So yeah, that would save a lot of people a lot of time.
Right? So anyway.
Yeah, I mean, even a tutorial section in the game would be better and maybe feel smoother to a veteran of that series if it just didn't have the explanation. It could be a simplified puzzle system or, you know, a little bit like, story heavy, but...
To be honest, like, there are some games that I know how to play, but I still look at the tutorial just, you know, as a reminder. Maybe it's been a while since I played it last. So just make the tutorial faster, you know? Just make it so I can just, you know, blow through it and, okay, now I remember that you can press L and it does this. All right.
Sure.
Let's get on with the game.
Sure. My next point is, again, you know, someone posted on Negative World there was a Pokemon, an actual MMO that some people created illegally, and I was interested to see what this would be like. So I downloaded it and I checked it out, and perhaps this is exactly why they don't go the MMO route with Pokemon, because, I mean, I played it for like 15 or 20 minutes and I was just like, this is ridiculous, because it was just, you know, like hundreds of people in the same area and everyone's just like, battle, battle, trade, battle, you know?
It makes the, you know how the concept of Pokemon where people just stand and stare in one direction?
Right.
It's kind of ridiculous. Well, like, yeah, I can imagine if everyone's just asking battle, trade, battle, like, right. It's like a bunch of sociopaths just...
Right. Well, and so this is why, you know, maybe if it were, you know, handled by a professional team, you know, you would have different servers that max out at a certain number of people or whatever. But what I was thinking was, a good middle ground would be, you know, to just have like the people who are on your friends list. You know, we can populate each other's world. So, Steven, if you're online and you're playing and I'm online and I'm playing, you know, I would just get a little notification, you know, oh, Steven is in Veilstone, or, you know, do you want to go hang out with Steven? And then, you know, we could travel together, fight together, do, you know, even in the game, you'll have like NPCs who will come and be like the second person in a two Pokemon battle, you know? So just sort of that kind of experience is really all I'm asking for, because I feel like the whole world of Pokemon, it's, you know, if you watch the show or even just playing through the games, I mean, it always seems to be this sort of moral of like, you know, we're traveling together and we're accomplishing things together and, you know, we're all happy, shiny friends and everything. But then if it's just a purely single player experience with, you know, the battles, it's, yeah, you know.
it is kind of contradictory, because the first season, or couple seasons perhaps, of the Pokemon show way back in the day was Ash, Brock, and Misty. You know, it was the three of them. And that played into a lot of the story. And then even on Team Rocket, it wasn't just one person. It was, you know, a duo. And then Meowth, who made their third person. And why that's not represented in the games is mysterious.
Yeah, and I just think that this would be like a really, you know, a not very invasive way that they could pull it off. I would even be okay with, you know, the way that they do random opponents in Mario Kart, where, again, it's not all of a sudden you're up against 100 crazy people. It's a limit of, you know, 7. Mm-hmm. So even if it was randoms online, but each little world were limited to a group of 7, and you could just sort of walk up to someone and just one at a time say, trade battle. Or, you know, just venture together. Just, you know, like, hey, where are you headed? You know, what gym badge are you working on next? Oh, there's this kind of Pokemon in this area. Let's go there and we'll help you capture one.
Well, when randomly kind of, you know, looking for a co-op or opponents for you or whatever, just people to play with, they could easily go based on checkpoints in the game to only link you up with
or
people
badges.
Who are, and yeah, badges or other kind of checkpoints. And, you know, you're only ever going to meet up with people who are in your same area.
Yeah, I think that would make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
And that brings me to, I also think, did anyone play Phantasy Star Zero on the DS?
Not I.
Okay. Guillaume, no? Okay. we'll edit in a, no, I have not.
did we lose
actually,
him?
Actually, I just did such a good impression, we don't have to. Okay. Well, anyway, what they had in that game was, you know, they didn't have voice chat, but you could use the lower screen on the DS to just write out a message. And that's really, I think, the extent of the communication that you would need to pull off something like this. You know, I don't think you necessarily need to have full voice chat implemented or anything like that. And then let's see, I got two more things.
Okay.
First of all, you know, I think that, and this sort of speaks to speeding up the game a little bit. The HMs, the moves that you need to, like, progress geographically around the world. I think we need to get rid of this, like, question before each time you use them.
Yes.
It reminds me of when I used to play Resident Evil with other people in the room. And, you know, you'd get to a door or something. It would say, like, do you want to use the red key? And I always used to joke that, like, really, they should be asking, do you want to advance in the game? I feel the same way about every time they ask, you know, would you like to use cut on this tree that's in your way? It's like, well, of course I would. And you don't need to ask me that. Like, I've got the Pokemon in my party. He's got the move. Let's go.
And then say you didn't. What kind of ramifications is it where, you know, if you do, it doesn't matter.
Right. When would be a good time not to?
I mean, yeah, I mean, Rock Smash, none of those rocks, like, you don't need them there.
No.
Any of the puzzles with the rocks design are, you know, they'll have non-destructible ones, so that way you don't screw yourself over it.
Right. And so, like, I'm in a part, even today in Pokemon Platinum, where, you know, you're going between all these little, I guess shoals is the term, you know, little patches of sand that stick up from the water. So when I'm going in between, you know, I have to keep opting in
to hop on your Pokemon, yeah.
Yeah. And it's just kind of annoying when you're trying to explore an area that is meant to be explored. I mean, that's like an off-the-beaten-path kind of area.
It's the Pokemon version of Iron Boots.
Yes. Yeah. Precisely. Yeah. And then the last thing, and this sort of goes along with that a little bit, you know, I think we've reached the point technologically where we could pull off this game in, like, full polygonal 3D. So like when we use a hidden move and we get on top of the Pokemon to use Surf, like we should be able to see that Pokemon. Like it shouldn't be this shadowy mystery conglomerate.
Blob.
The average of all possible Pokemons that could use this move.
I mean, they all kind of look like Lapras, you know, in the end.
I don't even know. I feel like when I use Fly, it kind of looks like a flying, like a manta ray or something. And I know that doesn't make But, and so, yeah, so, you know, I mean, full 3D, I'm thinking of like the way Ocarina of Time, was played out. Like, and this is one thing that might sound kind of blasphemous because it's getting away from the top down 2D with the, you know, the little little sprites, but I think that would be the kind of thing that would just add so much to this feeling of adventuring through this world. And I don't, you know, the thought I put into it, I don't think you would really lose very much. I don't know. What's your immediate reaction to that idea of like an OOT type world, that you use to navigate Pokemon instead of the little like SNES kind of sprites?
You'd have to kind of get used to the, you know, not necessarily invisible walls, but the very constructed linear paths, because Pokemon definitely is designed around that.
Mm.
You can't have a Hyrule Field in Pokemon Black, you know what I mean? It's got to have stuff in it, it's got to have boundaries. That makes sense. But, I mean, you get past that. I mean, that's more of just a decision to suspend your disbelief a little bit. And at that point, then, yeah, I think I'd like to see that.
I think even going along with the Zelda thing, I mean, I think if they did kind of like a Wind Waker sort of cell shading approach, I think that might soften the blow because it would look a little bit more like the cartoon. And that's what the art style seems to be based off of when you look at the, you know, the packaging and all that. And then the last piece of that would mean that the battles are, you know, fully animated, which they mostly are in Battle Revolution for the Wii. I've never owned that game. I've never played it, but I've seen videos of it. So clearly, you know, Nintendo is capable of this sort of thing. It's just a matter of whether or not they would ever want to implement it in one of their flagship games.
Well, it'd be great to have. I think more so than an MMO, Pokemon game would be, as far as dreams are for all of us, is to have something like you're saying with the OOT style overworld, but with like Battle Revolution battles and, you know, Pokemon Snap mini games and kind of combining all of that into one cohesive Pokemon product. I'm not sure why they're so apprehensive to do that.
Because I'm thinking, like, how fun would it even be just to, you know, let's say you stumble onto, you know, you're in the game with two of your friends and you can actually, you know, they don't go to a separate screen to do their battle. The battle just plays out in the normal 3D world. So you can just even be observing and just sort of spectating like a sport, which is kind of what Pokemon is in some sense. I mean, even in the world, it's like a sport. So anyway, so that pretty much, concludes my Pokemon rant and things that I would love to see happen in the series that maybe will happen, but I'll probably be dead by the time they do.
Pokemon rant sounds like a less entertaining version of the Pokemon rap.
When they when they finally get to Pokemon Uranium in 2050 and they and they implement all of these things, that'll be a great game.
Yeah, the only thing I want to say real quick, I know that we're running over time, is that I think that it would be really helpful for that whole pacing thing that you're talking about. If maybe, like, instead of having, well, it'd be somewhat pacing, but also just kind of ability to utilize your move slots better, is to have, you know, items like, or items to replace things like Surf and Fly. You just get to hold an item that just gets to set on your person like a town map, but is always active.
Yeah,
so
I...
That way you don't have to have Surf. Like, I know that I'm going to get a water Pokemon soon in my game, and I'm going to have to put Surf on him. Because I'm not going to want to swap out. And Surf's a powerful move, but you know what? I just got cut, and cut sucks. So I always end up putting him on, like, a, like, you know, whatever gopher or chipmunk-type character is in the beginning, you know?
Right.
I just shove it on him, and then I bring him out when I need to, and put him back when I don't. And it's kind of a pain in the ass.
Yeah, I skipped over that on my HM's part, but I did have that in there that, you know, what you could do is just have, like they do now, where certain Pokemon can learn certain HMs and some can't. So you could just say once you get it, all the Pokemon in your party that can do it, they all can. So you would just need to make sure you have one of those with you at the time when you...
Like an activator.
Yeah. So you wouldn't need to waste a spot of their four moves to use it. You would just still need to make sure you have one of them on your team.
And then just, you know, don't let those be able to be used in battle, of course. You know, have your own version of Surf or Cut or whatever.
Right. Because, and there's so many, I mean, they really are redundant. I mean, there's so many moves in Pokemon. It's not like we would be at a loss if those eight are not able to be used in battle.
Right. Well, Flash is like one of 20 different accuracy-reducing moves.
Right,
you know,
exactly.
That any Pokemon that can learn Flash can learn, you know.
Yep. So thank you for indulging me on that topic.
Well, thank you for bringing it up. Any last comments, Guy?
Woo! Pokemon!
That a boy.
Gotta catch them all.
Spoken like a Pokemaniac.
Yeah, I didn't say anything during this topic because I just love Pokemon so much. No, but seriously, I think a lot of what you said would help, you know, get me into Pokemon more, I'm sure. The, word design, weird interface choices really.
And now too, with like turn-based games, RPGs becoming less and less kind of a thing. You know, our personal just attention spans kind of crave these more interactive, flowing RPGs like we've been discussing this whole topic. And so, yeah, maybe at this point, Guy, you just could really give a shit about a turn-based game like that. You'd rather have something a little more involved and immediate.
Well, unless it's Persona.
No, I do like turn-based combat and things like that. It's more like the weird, you have to give up a slot, you know, for surf or things like that.
Yep.
It just, you know, like, let me play the game. Don't make me fight the interface. That's all I'm asking.
Yeah, you don't need 25% of the lower screen dedicated to each move in your inventory, you know?
That's true. Unless you tap with fat fingers. But alas, that was a good topic. Shall we move on to the final topic?
Let's move on, Stephen. What do you want to talk about?
Okay, mine is, as usual, a non-topic topic, sort of. I mean, I have some things I want to discuss, but generally I want to get a discussion going about, as I've hinted already, time splitters. Which, you know, especially these days, which I'm not playing every first-person shooter out there, especially being a primary Nintendo owner, I'm missing out on a lot, I guess. But from what I've gathered from just being a spectator, a lot of it is these, you know, war shooters, and they all have the same kind of general themes of, you know, aliens or war or whatever. And after, you know, GoldenEye and Perfect Dark came out, which were kind of really, you know, obviously key first-person shooters in their time, it kind of ended up shifting that way. After Halo, which Halo was pretty novel, but even that apparently has gotten stale over the years from what I've gathered. And Time Splitters was a series that just really, when everyone else was trying to be super serious about their guns, you know, in a world where that was existing, Time Splitters was throwing monkeys at you constantly. Monkeys and gingerbread men and ducks. And these people were all massacring each other, but it was hilariously awesome. And the level design and music was top-notch, you know? And they kind of went graphically in more of a Nintendo approach where they didn't try to get the sharpest graphics, but they just kind of went a little more cartoony. But it totally works. And I'd never played Time Splitters 1 because it never came out on a Nintendo system, but Time Splitters 2 and 3, 3 in particular, were just such excellent games for me. And the controls were pretty tight, the levels were super varied, and there was a lot of content in it, both in the main campaigns and in the multiplayer content. And I have such a fondness for this. I have a fondness for these games on the level of Animal Crossing, and you guys, you know, should both know by now how much I love that series, despite my occasional qualms with it. But and the reason this whole thing's kind of in my head right now is partially because of our discussion on, like, multiplayer games and that kind of thing, but there's I've been part of a Facebook group for a little while that's trying to get Time Splitters 4 made, because what happened after the third one didn't do so hot, the second one apparently did pretty well, the third one didn't do so hot, and then Free Radical, they kind of got disbanded, they went bankrupt. And actually, I'm pretty sure, I mean, this is a while ago, but I'm pretty sure they showed up one day and the doors were locked.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, like the company, most of the employees weren't even aware that this was happening to them. And I'm pretty damn sure that's true. I vaguely remember that. So it was kind of a shock. And obviously, the one game that everyone, at least in my circles, really remembered from Free Radical was the Time Splitter series. And Crytek ended up buying them and kind of picking up the pieces, at least buying hiring the various people who were working on these kinds of games. But that still doesn't change the fact that Time Splitters 3 didn't sell as well as other games at the time, you know, for whatever reason that may be. I certainly know it's not quality, it's just maybe the interest of the market was going towards the Call of Duties and the Halo and that kind of thing. And I mean, there's no doubt that Time Splitters is more of a niche product, but So there's this petition going on to try to get a Time Splitters 4 made, and I guess, you know, there just a few months ago there was an article I read where an HD downloadable version of Time Splitters 2 had been produced but never released, and it probably wasn't completely finished, but it was quite on its way. So now there's also a petition perhaps to get an HD collection, which I think would be pretty cool. And so I guess I wanted to see what you guys knew about Time Splitters, if you had any memories of it. Maybe where the placement of kind of a cartoony, lighthearted first-person shooter really exists in this day and age. Because besides that, I mean, The Conduit, you know, was one of the main first-person shooters that the Wii had. And that wasn't really lighthearted, but I also remember having purchased for the GameCube, it was called 13, and it was kind of a comic book-style first-person shooter. And that, you know, tried to be a little more serious, but it still had a great kind of cel-shaded look to it and everything. And, you know, I don't know. I think that there's just something special about those kind of games that separate themselves from the browns and greens of everything else. In Time Splitters 3, I know that, you know, there's like a disco level where you kind of play for a couple levels as this disco spy, kind of like an Austin Powers almost, with like a crazy porn stash. And you play alongside him, because you play the same character in the third game, but you're teamed up in each level, or set of levels with a new character. And so you play with this porn stash, Austin Powers, and then later you're actually playing, in a cool twist, you're actually playing with yourself from a previous level. And you actually can, I mean, it's not actually you being recorded, obviously, but you end up kind of, like, in the very first level, you play through this kind of canyon, and it's a space shooter thing. Because you're obviously hopping time through times and everything. And then like 4 or 5 levels later, you go through that same level again, but from the top of the canyon. And you realize that at various moments you were helping yourself out. And just very inventive thought, you know, story like that. And it was a cohesive story. Yeah, it was really
pretty
awesome.
Cool.
And then of course, like one of my favorite levels was I'm not sure exactly what time period, but kind of like a European castle, maybe in the early 30s or something. And you're just kind of helping this goofy explorer, like an Indiana Jones, if he was maybe a drunk uncle, you know? And it was just so cartoony, but so still engrossing. And then one other thing I'll mention, too, from that game. Again, the third one's a little more fond for me, so that's why I recall it a lot better. But there's also a level where you're going through a mansion with some, like, chick who I think she's wearing a tight shirt that says slut on it, and like a schoolgirl outfit, and she's totally kind of like a rude teen, but she's totally the one you have to help get you out of the zombie house, and complete with a zombie moose who is coming to attack you at one point in the level. It was just excellent, you know. I mean, I can't even remember the whole cohesive storyline anymore, but it did link it all together, and it allowed for a lot of variety in the same game. So every level feels fresh, and there was tons of weapons to use, and you know. And I'm getting out of breath just like talking about it. But that was just a single campaign, and then they had a really great level editor for multiplayer maps. You could fully deck out various multiplayer levels with lights and traps, and you know, ammo points where they spawn, where your character spawns. It was so detailed. And then there was like 100 characters, and you can unlock them in all these different ways. There was the challenge modes, kind of like in Perfect Dark, except they were more fleshed out. It was so effing deep, guys. And so I have such a fondness of it, and I guess I'll turn it over to you guys so I just don't spend 20 minutes talking about it. But, I mean, what are your experiences with these games? And do you feel that there really should be, like, with every serious first-person shooter, there should always be kind of a companion piece, you could say, you know?
I played Time Splitters 2 and 3 on the GameCube. Time Splitters 2 didn't really have a very cohesive story, as far as I can remember. Maybe that's why you don't really remember what it was. I don't think there was any. Like, mostly remember a series of stages, only barely stitched together, you know, in one mission, you would see, like, the text before your vision would be, okay, you're this guy, Capone Leone, and you have to take out this mob boss, and, you know, that's it. That's the setting. And, you know, then you're in a 40s New York setting, whatever. Like, so, yeah, like, the second game didn't really have much of a story. The third game, I remember it trying harder. But in a way, like, I don't want to come across as a hater, because I definitely enjoyed the games, but I do think that for a game that had such a nice look to it, you know, such a nice cartoony look to it, and such a, you know, no pretensions, you know, like it didn't take itself too seriously. I find that it kind of lacked character in a surprising way. I mean, I get the joke, like the main character in the third one was a bald space marine with weird goggles. Okay, like I'm sure it's kind of a comment on first-person shooters in general. So, but he still was kind of generic, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, sure, monkeys are fun and everything, but the game didn't really compare to other games that are cartoony and that do try to go the more narrative route. For instance, a Ratchet and Clank, which has a lot of shooting, sure, but it's also got, you know, more of a cohesive story and probably better dialogue and better written jokes. So, I don't know. Like, I feel like TimeSplitters almost had it, but it really needed better writers and a little bit more of a personality.
Now,
you know, like,
if they made another one, though, like the petition is kind of fighting for, would you give it another chance? I mean, do you think that it's possible to make a TimeSplitters game then that kind of hits those notes, or do you think it's just kind of a done idea?
I think that if, yeah, if they could, you know, manage to do those elements right, the game could be quite good. I'm not sure if I would get it personally, because I'm kind of not really playing first-person shooters anymore. Back then, I did have people to play with, and like we're going back to my topic now. Today it's a little bit more, it's a little bit harder to find people to compete with, and I don't really play online all that often, except maybe on the PC where most of my long distance friends are. So yeah, I can't really see myself buying it. I would perhaps check out an HD remake of 2 or 3, but then again, I don't think I've ever bought a single HD remake of a game I already owned in some form.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I don't think they can count on my support.
You know, there was in that petition or on Facebook, they were just saying, well, okay, hey, so should we make a major petition on this site for TimeSplitters 4, or should we do it for an HD remake compilation or whatever? And I ended up voting for the compilation, but I mean, of course, I would like either. But that is one downside to that is, yes, I'd be getting those games in HD. It'd be nice to play the first one, first of all.
Right.
Because that would be new content. The second, third, though, I can still pop into my very Wii, because it plays GameCube games, and I could experience that again if I wanted to. I can't imagine them doing that with new content, or extra characters, or some sort of added incentive that would make me want to purchase that. So that is, even for myself, a little bit of a tougher sell. But I did buy Metroid Prime Trilogy, even though I had just paid, you know, like a year before full price for Metroid Prime 3, so I can be swindled, perhaps. especially if the HD remakes for, like, came out for the Nintendo and actually had maybe motion control versus shooter controls, because I think that, for me anyway, as someone who isn't a PC gamer, I'm not really sure how they compare, but as far as consoles are concerned, I think that that kind of control, like the conduit and stuff, is really superb. And could, you know, go well with an HD upgrade to TimeSplitters, but
you know, I guess I'm wondering what the general first person shooter crowd, you know, has there been a game that has been a little bit less serious that they've really embraced? I mean, I can kind of point to Team Fortress 2, although does that even really have like a campaign, or is it just kind of goofy? You know, like, is there even writing in that per se, or is it just sort of like, you know, this guy kind of looks funny and yells a funny catchphrase and rips someone's head off?
I can't really talk about Team Fortress 2. I haven't really played it that much. There are several tutorials, I guess, that do have some personality to them.
Okay.
And yeah, like, Valve is usually pretty good about writing dialogue, and even though Left 4 Dead is a game that's, you know, probably not worth playing by yourself, it's mostly multiplayer, the four different characters that you can control do talk to each other, and they say funny stuff, and it's surprising the amount of dialogue, different dialogue that they wrote and that they recorded and that you can go through. But yeah, like, there's nothing
Left 4 Dead is still, like, they're not, they might say funny things, but it's still serious.
Yeah. Yeah.
So to speak, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can't really think of a first person shooter that has the tone that that Time Splitters had. I guess something like Serious Sam has funny design, but again, it's more of a mindless kill everything in sight. It's kind of a first person twin stick shooter. You know, you got wave after wave of enemy that look weird. But yeah, there's not really, there's perhaps a little bit of that cartoony look, but yeah, it doesn't really compare.
Having, you know, again, I haven't played the Time Splitters game, but from how you're describing it, it sounds like more the vibe of, like a point and click adventure game, you know, like that sort of, style of comedy. Yes, no?
I don't have a lot of experience with those, so I can't really say.
Okay. I've played mostly LucasArts adventure games, and let's just say I don't think the writing really compares to quality.
Okay.
I think what I do want to say is kind of stand up on the counterpoint from what Guy was saying with the lack of charm because, I guess maybe I'm repeating this wrong, but like, because...
I think I said character.
Or character.
Or personality.
Yeah. I mean, like, I can understand that with, you know, in Future Perfect it is kind of, it's this, like you were saying, a bald army guy, kind of just going through the different time things. And in the second game, there isn't even a cohesive main character. You kind of quantum leap into other people.
Right.
But, you know, like, I guess the one thing that I really did like about it was just the variety. It was just,
yeah.
You know, in one level, I am in the 70s, sneaking onto a, you know, an evil base that is more or less like Dr. Evil's. And then in the next level, I am storming a castle. And then in the next level, I'm trying to get past, you know, like kind of an alien invasion on like a desert area. And then, you know, and then again, there's the haunted mansion or the zombie mansion and stuff like that. Like, I don't know. I think I really appreciate that. I think it's just fun. Even if it is broken up like that, I guess while I was kind of getting all mushy over the cohesiveness of Feature Perfect, it's not really essential for me. While I don't recall that much about the second game, it also might be due to time and the fact that I always preferred the controls in the third game, so I kind of recall that being, I played it more, but I remember, you know, it was somewhat cohesive, I guess. They had at least multiple stages in each little chunk because the Western level did have a few stages to it. I remember, I think the very beginning of Time Splitters 2 is you and like a Russian kind of James Bond style base and you're kind of breaking in, then you go down into the dam.
Yeah, and, it's absolutely a callback to GoldenEye.
Yeah, and but this time there's zombies and zombie labs and, you know, other things down there. And, you know, so, I mean, there was a, I guess, mini cohesive stories. And who knows if that's the way to go or if there should be, like, Feature Perfect where it was one long arc with even callbacks to yourself and that kind of thing.
Do you think that sort of, that level of variety might be what's keeping a game like this from getting greenlit, because they would have to essentially create, you know, 8 or 10, however many different locales there are. You know, like, it would be harder to reuse assets. I mean, is that the case? Or, like, when you go to those different areas, do you still fight the same enemies, or is it like, okay?
I mean, you might fight, like, humanoid-type characters, but, you know, in one thing they'll be zombies, and another thing they might be soldiers. I mean, there is a lot of... Actually, you know, there's a whole level in Feature Perfect where you're fighting robots and lasers and other things like that. So there is a lot of assets to create. There are a lot of assets to create and a lot of different levels. So maybe it is less...
I'm just thinking if sales were, you know, mediocre, I'm wondering if they would need really strong sales to justify a project like this as opposed to, you know, well, let's just make another thing.
Well, I don't think that Time Splitters was an especially big budget endeavor. I think that they did really, you know, the little that they had, they went a long way, you know, like they did have levels full of robots, and the robots perhaps had little, you know, different characteristics, but for the most part, they all look the same, right? Like, you had lots of robots, but one type of robot, or two types.
Yeah, I mean, there was a handful of types, but it definitely wasn't, it's not like each one's individually different. And the zombies in that zombie level were pretty much all the same. Big zombie, little zombie, and then, you know, weird zombie, but.
Yeah, and the campaign usually would be, what, like 10 to 12 missions long? So there was variety, but I don't think it was a bank-breaking variety.
But I think time-wise, though, I think like time and creativity, it may not cost that much to do it, but I don't think people want to sit there and think of seven different scenarios. They want to focus on one, and perhaps in this day and age of like having that cinematic video game, it seems to sell better to have kind of that epic arc of, you know, some badass space marine or whatever you want to do, compared to the goofball who's kind of going to the porn stash time or the western, that kind of thing. You know, it's like an OCD game, or not an OCD game, ADD
game.
Yeah, that may not sell as well, you know. And that's kind of a shame.
So what do you think the chances are, if you were to slap a percentage on seeing a Time Splitters 4? Or
I think, for Time Splitters 4, I would say probably the chances overall are probably less than 50%. Mm. And they diminish all the time, I think. But for the chances for like a HD collection, I think, are greater. And I don't know. And like, it's one thing because sales, you know, the sales of those games is locked in. I mean, they don't sell them anymore. So whatever they made, that was what we knew. But there's these petitions that I've been seeing that, you know, on Facebook, you can go to the Facebook group 100,000 strong for Time Splitters 4. And whoever the heck is controlling that, I don't even know his name or her name, but they're definitely pushing the hell out of it because I get bugged on my Facebook all the time for it. and it's great though. And actually I can see that a few other, users, for Negative World are friends of that group as well, like me. I won't out them, but a few or many people who've been on the podcast, and so there's definitely an interest, and it may be a niche interest, but I don't know. To me, especially if you can do it for the right value, as far as the company's production values are concerned, how much it costs them to do it, both with money and with man hours and such, I think it could be a good move to still cater to the niche audience, you know. I mean, they do it all the time with other things. Not everything has to be mass appeal. And hell, it would be great if maybe Nintendo took the reins on this and said, you know, well, we'll publish it if you develop it.
You know, we'll have another Bayonetta 2 situation.
And I think that would really make a lot of people happy on Nintendo platforms, because this game really always catered to the GoldenEye Perfect Dark crowds, you know, but even more goofy. But just like the people who love those games, that was the gameplay style of these games. And, you know, in this game, there was no regenerating health bar. There was health packs. And, you know, it was very, very classic, to what you would expect as classic these days. And so, I think that the chances are not the best, but there's hope. And what we can't, you know, by we, I mean people who want this game to happen. You can't do it by sales anymore, but you certainly can do it by voice. You can definitely make it known. So if we really were able to get 100,000 people, and, you know, to say that they will buy this game, you know, uniques, well, that really would be incentive for a company to go forward with it.
Mm. And, did Free Radicals come out at all, like, to say, forget about it, guys, or anything? Like, what about Kickstarter? Have they shown any kind of distaste for it, or, like,
I think a Kickstarter is being discussed, maybe. I did look up some recent articles and such, and this one from Eurogamer.net, says that Crytek says that Time Splitters 4 fan interest is not high enough yet. So they want to see more of an interest before they actually are ready to invest on it. And at the time this article was done, in like August, early August of this year, there's 29,000 or so Facebook fans of that one page, and they're trying to get to 100,000. Mm. And the article kind of goes into description about how Crytek has been thinking about Time Splitters, and they've never stopped forgetting about it, and they still have all the original concept art and that kind of thing, and the notes. I mean, that all transferred over, but whether or not they want to go forward with it is up to, I guess, the fans. I think they're kind of dicking with us to a point, you know. I think they want to make sure it's a sure thing, and I don't really blame them either, but they could be dicking with us, but you know, I guess time will tell. But it's one of those games that, like, every year or two, it kind of bubbles up to the surface that, oh, hey, there's a rumor that this was, you know, in production or whatever. And so now I think fans are just really trying to speak out, Operation Rainfall style, and be heard, which I'm all for. But you know, we are a little over time with me, so I've said all I wanted to say. I guess I just want people to support those Facebook pages or whatever comes up if you're interested in the games, because there is a chance. And you know what? Just like with the lottery, if you don't play, there's no way of winning. But I still think this is better than the lottery as far as our chances of winning. Any other notes, guys, or no?
Well, you know, like as I said, I don't think I would get into this game, realistically, considering that I'm kind of clamping down on new game purchases and everything.
Right.
I used to kind of throw my money at games to support them in a way, but that's in the past. But yeah, like, you know, like I hope this happens. I know that the game has its fans, and we do need more games that don't take themselves too seriously. And there are other games such as Bulletstorm, which try to be funny and everything, but they do it in a very offensive and gross way. And
right.
I would really appreciate something a little bit more restrained and a little bit more in good taste, like Time Splitters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point.
Well, then I recommend you guys go sign those petitions, and whether or not you plan on getting the games, every signature helps, you know. At least for this last push, because if we have 100,000 signatures and then only 5,000 people buy the games, well, that kind of puts a kibosh on any other games. But at least we get the one, right?
Yep.
And it sounds like it's time for dinner somewhere.
Oh yeah. Yep, that's what's going on here.
So with that, we might as well wrap it up, unless you know, whoever that is would like to join us.
Amy, they can hear you making dinner.
Sorry.
She says sorry.
Oh, that's, well,
no problem.
We appreciate the sincerity. It's
we're
all right.
Done.
Yeah, we're done with this. It's
we're
perfect.
Done.
From now on, that should be our ending bell. We should just start hearing dishes, like books. I should start, you know, fixing up my desk, arranging things. And,
oh, Steven is losing interest again.
What's the music mean?
I need like a piano so I can just fall my, you know, lay my head onto it whenever I really lose interest. But anyway, so I guess we'll wrap it up. I really want to remind everyone really quick about Shocktober, which is currently still going on and will be for another 2 weeks or so, actually, all the way up through Halloween. And pretty much the gist of that is that we're just playing, you know, scary games, spooky games, and talking about them. It's kind of like Backlogus, but with a spooky feel. And you know, we're just trying to play. We're not trying to really tuck anything away. If you don't do it, whatever. The point isn't to complete the game per se, but it's to just enjoy it and discuss it and have a kind of a thematic game month. So
that's why I'm playing Pokemon. I mean,
yeah, hey, don't, Lavender don't, Tower or whatever.
Don't play with the lights off, am I right?
Yeah, hey, Gengar is a creepy. Haunter actually is even creepier. But there's nothing creepier than missing no. So, but yeah, so that wraps up another episode of the Negative World Podcast. We'd really like for you to comment on what you've heard, negativeworld.org. Simply find the thread associated to this episode when we post it. And if you don't want to subscribe to Negative World, you can reach us through the Facebook page. Simply search for negativeworld.org. And you can also follow us on Twitter at negative_world. Don't forget to subscribe to the Enhanced Podcast if you're interested in chapter markers and random chapter art that I might produce. And lastly, I want to thank you, Guillaume and Joe, for doing this.
Hey, no problem.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah. It was a great, great podcast this week.
Would you allow me one plug?
Sure, okay.
Go for it.
Well, every year, Radio for Nintendo does a live show for charity. The point is that we start basically around noon, I think, my time, and start podcasting live, and people can listen to us live. And the more people donate, the longer we have to go on. And so there are events, you know, every hour planned, and special guests. And so it's all for a good cause. And so just save the date, November 10th. You know, if you can listen and perhaps give, or at least, you know, spread the word, every little bit counts.
You know, playing, let's see, what November 10th is what day? That's Saturday?
It
that's
is
a Saturday.
Is it? Okay. So that's the day before Paper Mario comes out. Okay. Well, you know what?
So yeah, we're actually, I can't, you know, nothing is set in stone. We're still preparing the whole event, and holy crap, Johnny is really ambitious about the whole thing. So, you know, I can't really tease anything because anything could fall through, but we do hope to be talking about Paper Mario. We'll probably at least, at the very least, have the people reviewing it for Nintendo World Report talking about it.
Well, all you're going to say is Miyamoto. That's all you're going to say.
Yes, Miyamoto himself is going to be podcasting with us. That's it.
Miyamoto on Iwata's shoulders.
Via Bill Trinan, or whatever that guy's name is.
Well, yeah, I mean, as a fan of I am a fan of Negative World, but of Nintendo World Report, you know, the live episodes are always really, really good, and things get crazier as they get more tired. So you do want to continue to donate and keep that going. But the reason I brought up Paper Mario was I was going to say, you know, it'd be great to, you know, pick up your new game and sit there and listen and, you know, donate a few bucks. And but, of course, you know, play something else, but just tune in for sure. I think
2 out of the last 3 we've just put it on sort of our big the TV that's hooked up to our desktop and just sort of like left it on in the background all day, and it's always been really good. We've donated, it's a good cause, so
cool. Well, thanks for
looking forward to it
too. Yeah, awesome.
All right, well, you know, listen to that, and whenever we get this episode out, and the next episode, and all those, listen to both podcasts, because I've always been a big fan of theirs, and I'm a big fan of ours, too. So, thanks again, you guys, for doing this with me, and I encourage everyone else to come be a guest on the show.
Do it.
Yeah.
Hooray.
So, all right, you guys have a great night, and, you know, we'll see everyone else in a few weeks.
You too. Later, guys.
Bye.
See you.